listeners, and welcome to the GSS Weekly Edition for Saturday the 27th. Let's kick right into Monday's show, where we examine a little the Australian feel for gay marriage. How was your weekend? Hey, mine was pretty good, but let me tell you, it is starting to get mighty hot down here, and that's why I'm going to introduce a new theme for GSS. This is Naked Monday. That's right, this show is being recorded completely in the buff, because it's too hot for clothes. Yeah, and with that fabulous mental image, let's kick straight into the stories for today, assuming you can still hear what I've said and haven't suddenly curled up on the floor feeling slightly nauseous and your eyes going blind with the idea of naked Steve in front of you, which is entirely possible. Yeah, so first up, some news out of Australia. The Liberal frontbencher Eric Abetz says his party won't be changing its opposition to gay marriage anytime soon. Thousands of people marched through the streets of Melbourne on Saturday, calling on state MPs to support equal marriage rights for same-sex couples. The protesters want their politicians, who will go to the polls later this month, to send a message to federal MPs to change the Marriage Act. A senator is quoted as saying, "Marriage is the foundational institution of our society, especially for the bringing up of children." The coalition will approach the debate in a, quote, sensitive way, but maintains marriage is a heterosexual construct which should not be altered. Should not be altered? It's been altered many, many times over the last thousands of years. I mean, once upon a time, you'd need armed men to be standing next to you to defend you against marauding barbarians or attackers from another tribe. That's what the best man is. He's, you know, the head of your security for the marriage. You know, you used to have to sacrifice animals at a wedding. You know, there are lots and lots of ways that a marriage has already been altered. And as for being a heterosexual construct, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Anyone stupid enough to want to get married should be allowed to. Yeah. Okay. Now, staying in Australia for the moment, we have some interesting plastic surgery news popping up. Yeah. Plastic surgeons are pushing for flat-chested women to claim fake boobs on Medicare. Yeah. Already, hundreds of women are using taxpayer funds for breast enlargement surgery, and doctors said many more should be eligible on medical grounds. Women who have lost their breasts due to diseases such as cancer also fell into the category, you know, which is fair enough. The number of claims processed has gone up by 51% from 181 in 2004-2005 financial year to 274 in the past financial year. Now, the Australian Society of Plastic Surgeons wants the federal government to consider extending the taxpayer-funded benefits to flat-chested women who suffer what is known in the industry as hypomastia, having small breasts. Having small breasts. Society President Peter Callan said women might feel a, quote, loss of self-esteem due to undeveloped breasts. The quote continues. There are a certain number of women with significant hypomastia who would benefit from breast augmentation from both psychological and physical perspective. Hang on. Psychological, you can sort of argue for, you know, maybe, you know, I would argue long and hard against it because I don't like big fake breasts. I think they're bloody horrible. I can't understand the women who have them or the men that like them, but there you go. That's just me. But the physically, how can it be physically beneficial to cut open your chest, rip up the muscle tissue, stick some fake blobs of silicone underneath, and then seal it all back up again? That doesn't sound like it can be good physically to me. Yeah, anyway. The current rebates include a 75% benefit to surgery patients of $802 Australian. A Medicare spokeswoman said that the health agency did not reimburse for cosmetic breast enlargement and only covered clinically necessary breast surgery. All right, so Medicare, these are the people that handle our actually, thanks to Obama, I guess you all know what Medicare is by now. Our Canadians already knew. Yeah, it's our healthcare system, basically, which means that we don't have to pay for anything that we actually need, okay? If you just want things like, just for example, breast enlargement surgery, right? If you just want a surgery, then, you know, you're going to have to either pay for it through the nose or wait 10 to 20 years until there's an open spot in the lists. But if you actually need surgery, you will get it and the government will deal with it. The plastic surgeons are trying to say, you know, the government should pay for boob jobs, basically, or pay, 75% of the cost for boob jobs, which of course makes it much more affordable for people and means the plastic surgeons will get yet more kickbacks. I don't like plastic surgeons. I don't. I feel like they've taken their natural talent and their years of training and they've used it just to do something completely useless but highly profitable. Yeah, anyway, there you go. Now, our next story has been all over the news, I'm sure, but it still interests me, so I'm going to read it. In a seemingly offhand remark that caught the Roman Catholic world by surprise, Pope Benedict XVI, otherwise known as Pope ex-Nazi, appears to have relaxed, at least slightly, the Vatican's long-standing adamant opposition to the use of condoms. Wow. Welcome to 2010. In a book-length interview with a German journalist, portions of which were released on Saturday, the pontiff said that under some circumstances it might be acceptable for a prostitute, or in some translations, a male prostitute, to use a condom. Quote, "There can be single justified cases," Benedict said. "For example, when a prostitute uses a condom..." And this can be the first step toward a moralization, a first act of responsibility in developing anew an awareness of the fact that not everything is permissible and that we cannot do everything we want. However, he said, this is not the best way to overcome the infection of HIV. It is really necessary to humanize sexuality. Oh, my brain hurts. We'll read that last one again. This quote, from the Pope, it is really necessary to humanize sexuality. Oh, I so want to kick this guy in the motherfucking teeth. I just really do. My God. The Pope is saying we have to humanize sexuality. Do we? Do we? Does that include not raping little boys anymore? Because, you know, I could be all for that. Yeah, there you go. So, for our next story, over to Sanford in Florida. A Florida car dealership trying to drum up business is offering an unusual perk for potential used truck buyers, a free AK-47 assault rifle. Oh yeah. General sales manager Nick Janetta says that since the promotion was announced on Veterans Day, business has more than doubled at Nations Trucks in Sanford. Customers would have to pass a background check before using the $400 gun shop voucher. They also have the option of using the money towards other firearms, or they can request a check in that amount instead. The dealership has fielded some complaints about the deal. That's a surprise. Which Janetta acknowledges is controversial. No, it's not controversial. It's goddamn stupid. But he adds, quote, my buyer is absolutely a gun owner. No question. Well, huh? Where? Yeah, all right. No, that's fine. That's fine. That's fine. Why wouldn't you give out AK-47s to people that are buying trucks? Yeah, wonderful. All right, well, we're near the end here, and we got time for just one more story of absolute stupidity, which, of course, entertains me greatly. An auto mechanic received a repair order which read, check for clunking sound when going around corners. Taking the car out for a test drive, he made a right turn, and a moment later he heard a clunk. He then made a left turn and again heard a clunk. Back at the shop, he opened the car's trunk and soon discovered the problem. Promptly, he returned the repair order to the service manager with the notation, removed bowling ball from trunk. Yeah, excellent. A bowling ball. The stupidity of some people is just unmeasurable. Speaking of stupid, James comes in on Tuesday for a story about the drunk girl stuck in a clothes dryer. Yeah, the girl is stupid, not James. Yeah.
Today I was going to talk to you about onions. I had a lot of information prepared for you about onions, but halfway through the preparation of all this wonderful information about onions, I decided that onions just weren't that interesting. So, instead, I've got a drunk girl who got stuck in a clothes dryer. This story from the Daily Telegraph. I'll read it out to you. A girl climbs into a clothes dryer after having a few too many drinks, then struggles to get out. Meanwhile, her friends capture the hilarity on video. That's the end of the news story. And the video is exactly that. If you feel like being entertained by watching for 3.5 minutes a girl attempt to get out of a clothes dryer. Now, as I look at the beginning shots, you can see a foot protruding out, just the end of an arm, and what appears to be the edge of her bum, which is covered by underwear. And from there, you can see that she slowly is just too inebriated to figure out how to get out of this clothes dryer. She can do it, she knows she can do it, but she doesn't have the muscle coordination, the strength, the mind control to make it happen. And of course, her friends very helpfully coax her out. Highly recommend it. Just Google, drunk girl gets stuck in a clothes dryer. Enjoy. Next, and going with the whole drunk getting half naked sort of thing, a naked man in a boot has been caught on Google cameras. Yes, for Google Maps. Steve, I know that you love this. Google is prying into our private lives. And this man's privates have been out in the open. This news story comes to us from 9MSN. Google Street View faced a storm of protest before launching its service in Germany, and apparently for good reason. An image of a naked man lying in the boot of a car surfaced on the website on Friday, the same day the Street View service was launched in the country. How's that? They launch it, and straight away they start uploading stuff straight away. That's amazing. The photo shows the man lying naked in the back of the car, trying to open or close the boot door on top of himself. We're not sure which. The photo was taken in the city of Mannheim, which was one of 20 cities, including Berlin and Hamburg, that were photographed by the Google camera cars. The image was promptly blurred out, but some media outlets captured the video before it was edited. Nearly 240,000 residents in Germany opted to have their houses blurred out before the Street View service went live on the internet. This has been the only time Google has allowed people to choose whether their home should be blurred or not. Now, Google camera cars, you'd think they'd catch quite a few things on video. So I went searching, and I have found a few. We've got a shot here of a man in his car leaning out with his finger, his middle finger, extended, and he's given someone the bird on Google cameras. Yeah, we also have some almost nude women walking down a street eating ice cream. And we also have somebody who had just been pulled over by the police and getting told off and getting themselves a nice little ticket. And the last one is that we have a picture of a man doing a towel change at the beach. He's struggling. He's got his pants down around his ankles. He's got this towel that's fallen off of him, the surfboard lying next to him. And he's looks like he owns a Mercedes-Benz as well. So yes, just be careful when you're out there. If you do see a camera or a car with a camera-looking thing on top of it, which you probably never will because it's disguised like, I don't know, a superhero or something. Yeah, just be careful what you do in public because you might end up on Google Maps. Speaking of superheroes, MSNBC.MSN.com brings us a story from Seattle. They are a group of costumed and caped do-gooders out to fight crime, and now they're on the streets of Seattle. A handful of men and women say they're part of a national group of real-life superheroes, and locally they call themselves the Rain City Movement. Their website says they embody the values presented in superheroic comic books. Now they've organized here and are patrolling Seattle streets at night. But police say these superheroes could cause harm. They carry tasers, nightsticks, and pepper spray. But they don't carry guns. Not in Seattle. Down in Florida, you buy a truck, you get a gun. Yep. But not in Seattle. Tasers, nightsticks, and pepper spray. At a Capitol Hill gas station last week, a bystander mistook a masked superhero for a masked robber. Police warned someone could get hurt. Quote from Mr. Mark Jameson, spokesman for the Seattle Police Department, says, "If you want to dress up as a superhero, that's great. Go to the conventions." Well, I actually reckon that they do have superhero conventions. You can find out more about them on www.reallifesuperheroes.org. Enjoy. Now, moving on. Bit of futurism, I love it. Soon, we will all be able to fly around. Forget cars, we can have little jetpacks to fly around in. And only for $100,000. Yes, the Jetsons age is finally arrived. I love it. About bloody time. This story comes to us also from MSNBC. A personal aircraft that requires minimal training and no pilot's license is about ready for production. We're trying to make the world's easiest to fly aircraft, Richard Lauder, chief executive of New Zealand-based Martin Aircraft Company, tells Discovery News. Our goal is to create a Segway for the sky where the principles of flying would be very simple. It certainly looked that way in the movies and TV shows of the 1960s and 1970s when everyone from James Bond to Gilligan strapped on a jetpack for a thrilling change of scene. I think there's an interest in this type of flying vehicle ever since man started to fly. The key problem has been what is called the weight to thrust ratio, which basically boils down to the conundrum that the heavier you are, or the longer you want to stay in the air, the more power you need, which in turn means you have to carry more weight. Martin Aircraft set out to build a flying machine that would fall within U.S. aviation regulations for ultralights, defined as aircraft weighing 254 pounds or less. Designed for one person, holding no more than 5 gallons of fuel, and capable of moving at a top speed of 55 knots or 63 miles per hour. Or it's about 85-90 kilometers an hour. 254 pounds or less. Now, I'm not sure if that actually includes the weight of the person or not. You would hope not, because that would rule out a lot of the population. And the good thing about this is that the company is also developing a heftier jetpack intended for military, emergency rescue services, and other government uses, as well as a remotely piloted unmanned version. Oh, good. Yes. So it's going to sell for about $100,000. So if you're a bit of a George Jetson fan, then, take a second mortgage out on your house and get yourself a jetpack. Very cool. Oh, like they'll drop in price soon, you know. They'll be like $5,000 in a few years. I think I'll wait. Now, on to our final story of the day, and this is following on from a story that Steve brought to us yesterday about the government paying for boob jobs. Well, I have found a doctor who has been carrying out breast examinations in bars. Well, at least he said he was a doctor. This story comes to us as well from MSNBC. A woman posed as a physician and duped at least two other women into undergoing breast exam at her hands in Boise area nightclubs, according to the police. Christina Ross, 37, remains in the Ada County Jail on two felony counts of practicing medicine without a license. So she didn't get put in jail for touching these other women's boobs. An Idaho judge set bond at $100,000 on Wednesday. Oh, that's a shame. She could have bought a jetpack for that money. Police said Ross introduced herself to victims, one at a downtown Boise bar and the other at a nightclub in a Boise suburb, as a plastic surgeon named Berlin Azishishawana, a name that turned out to be bogus. The two women told Boise officers they believed Ross was a physician because of her apparent medical knowledge, and they agreed to undergo what they thought were breast exams, which happened at the bars. As part of a ruse, Ross allegedly gave the women the telephone number of a real licensed plastic surgeon in Boise, the state capital. Staff at the medical office became alarmed at the number of calls they received from women in recent weeks attempting to confirm appointments or surgeries with a Berlin Azishishawana. According to charging documents. Medical workers on Tuesday alerted Boise police about the pattern, and later they arrested Ross. Idaho court records show that Ross was arrested for petty theft in the spring and that the arrest warrant was issued to a Christopher John Ross. Yes, Ross had a previous criminal record as a man, but identified herself as a woman who was booked into Ada County Jail as a female. Consequently, the Idaho Department of Correction Services listed Ross as a transgendered in 2004. Her gender was shown in the documents as MTF, meaning male to female, in relation to a prison sentence stemming from an aggravated battery charge. Cosmetic surgical procedures Ross discussed with the victims after she touched their breasts under the guise of medical evaluation included breast augmentation and liposuction. The court on Wednesday found Ross was eligible for public defender and set a preliminary hearing on the two felony charges for December 1. If convicted, Ross could face a maximum fine in prison and a fine of up to $10,000 for each count.
A transgender breast inspector. Why did I never think of that? Damn. And now it's time for our first musical piece for this week. This is Circus Underground. That was Save You by Circus Underground. Now we're going to kick over very briefly to a very angry report from me about the beginning of the Korean situation. Hello, listeners, and welcome to GSS episode 77 for Wednesday, the 24th of November 2010. If you think I sound a little bit pissed off, it's because I am. News out of Korea. At least two South Korean soldiers are dead after North Korea began an artillery assault on a disputed island controlled by the South around 2:30 p.m. local time on Tuesday. The exchange is amongst the fiercest clashes since the Korean War effectively ended in 1953. The attack came after South Korea refused to halt military exercises in the area, though North Korean state media reports that the South fired first. What a shock. The South responded to the onslaught with artillery of its own, and residents of the island, which has both civilian and military installations, escaped to the mainland or went into shelters. The North has reportedly dropped more than 200 shells on the island, leaving at least 70 homes ablaze. The clash comes after weeks of tensions following Pyongyang's announcement of a new uranium enrichment facility. These fucking psychos are going to have nukes soon, okay? And just a month after North Korean leader Kim Jong-il announced that his fucking psychotic younger son Kim Jong-un to be his heir, the island Yeonpyeong was the site of two previous deadly clashes in recent years, in 2002 and 1999. Officials from Beijing to Washington were on high alert as tensions mounted between Seoul and Pyongyang. The White House strongly condemns the attack and is firmly committed to the defense of South Korea, according to a statement from Robert Gibbs that called for North Korea to halt its belligerent action. In addition to the two fatalities, 17 soldiers and 3 civilians were wounded in the attack. I hate to say it, I'm not a massive fan of war, but sooner we go in there and wipe those people the fuck out, the better. Someone's a little bit angry. And now let's kick on to Wednesday's show with some ridiculous laws out of America. Let's head straight over to Philadelphia in America. This story coming out from Reuters. An American rights group is suing the police in Pennsylvania for issuing tickets which carry a jail sentence to people for swearing. A jail sentence for swearing. The American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, which filed the lawsuits earlier, argues that the right to use profanity is protected by the US Constitution. Fucking oath it is. And a quote, "Unfortunately, many police departments in the Commonwealth do not seem to be getting the message that swearing is not a crime," said Mariek Tuthill of the ACLU of Pennsylvania. "The courts have repeatedly found that profanity, unlike obscenity, is protected speech." Obscenity, oh good, they're going to go and define it, because I wasn't sure what the difference was. Obscenity, under the Supreme Court's definition, refers to speech that mainly appeals to the prurient interest in sex, according to the ACLU. Interesting. So maybe fuck off would be okay, but go and get fucked would be beyond the pale. I'm not sure. I don't know. I'd have to play around with that some more, and I'm quite willing to do so. Anyway, one lawsuit involves an unidentified woman in Luzerne County in northeast Pennsylvania who was given a citation which carries a maximum penalty of $300 and 90 days in jail after she yelled an offensive word at a motorcyclist who swerved close to her in October 2008. In a separate case, a man was arrested, cited for disorderly conduct, and briefly jailed after shouting a double expletive at a policeman who was writing him a parking ticket. The two are amongst at least 750 people in Pennsylvania a year who face illegal disorderly conduct charges because of the use of profanity in Pennsylvania, the ACLU said. 750-odd people a year. Just for yelling out naughty words. Nice. No, I like that one. All right. The next one now, from Manchester, New Hampshire. Police say that a woman charged with robbing a pharmacy wasn't hard to find. I should have squeezed this one in when I was doing the idiot criminals thing, but there you go. This didn't pop up till afterwards. Her name was on the license plate of the getaway car. Yeah, brilliant. Police say a motorist watched the woman flee from a Rite Aid parking lot in Manchester. The witness also reported seeing the woman toss items from her car Friday morning. The vanity plate read B. Usher. A personalized license. Oh, police say the car was registered to 43-year-old Bonnie Usher, who might be the B. Usher of the vanity plate, yeah, who was arrested at her home. Police recovered stolen money and found a ski mask tossed from the car. An official at the Hillsborough County Jail says Usher was being held Sunday night on $60,000 bail. Yeah, I'm not sure the bail is necessary. I'm pretty sure that people this stupid, you could leave the doors open and then they still wouldn't work out that they could leave. Anyway, this one, sent in by Punk Space Cadet. Evangelical Christians in Brazil have apparently, get a load of this, banned the use of USB connections, after claiming the technology is the mark of Satan worshippers. Yeah, okay. Reach over over to your computer right now. Grab a USB thing. Take a look at the plug. You see on top there the little symbol with the three spikes, the little trident? That's a satanic trident. That is the devil's data port. Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, so that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Why would anyone possibly ever have anything against religious folks? I don't understand. All right. Our next one from Indonesia. And this one is currently big news in that country. It's a little freaky. Metal wires about 10 to 20 centimeters long grow from a woman's body. Yeah. Now, skeptics initially thought that it must be self-inflicted. Doctors, however, have other theories, but have given up on providing any scientific or medical explanations. The woman had this problem for 17 years and is currently being investigated by the Ministry of Health. Doctors and specialists found that the wires are also inside her body. At this stage, there were no current medical explanations or any case ever existing. Hence, there is but one other possible consideration, says the story. Occult magic. Mm-hmm. I should point out, this story is actually from Indonesia and it's translated into English rather badly. I'm doing quite a bit of editing while I'm reading this. Her name is... Oh, holy crap. Nauseida. I don't know. A 40-year-old kindergarten teacher from Sangatta, East Kutai. Her first symptoms started manifesting in 1991. The metal wires grew out of her chest and her belly. The pictures are mighty freaky. There was no explanation then or now. During the first week, wires kept falling off her body and were gone. A month later, the wires grew back again, and from that time onward, the wires did not fall. They kept growing. One of her sisters said she tried to help by trimming the wires. Alas, whenever she trimmed the wire retreated as if it were hiding and then popped up in another part of the woman's body. What the hell is going on here? There have been four medical specialists taking this matter seriously and have treated her in several ways. As a result, doctors can't figure out exactly what is happening to her. They have taken X-ray images from her stomach and found there are more than 40 metal wires inside her, and some of them are bursting out of her skin. They look like a living phenomenon. The wires are mobile and can change location at will. Thus, the doctors are forced to use a magnet to scan the exact position of the wires. The wires burst out without any symptoms of tetanus, but she says they're hurting her like when needles sting. Yeah, I can imagine. Metal wire poking through your skin from the inside. That's not going to feel good. No. All right, our last one for today. Yeah, no, it's not a full 10-minute episode. This is just making up the 7.5 minutes that I owe you after losing the plot this morning. Californian Bill Helco was thrilled when he had the winning numbers in the local lottery, the first prize being $412,000. He straight away went and ordered a Porsche, booked a family holiday in Hawaii, and had a champagne dinner with his wife and friends at an expensive Hollywood restaurant. When he went to pick up his winnings, yeah, he did that after. He found that 9,000 other people had also won first prize, and his share of the jackpot was $45. Bad luck, Bill. $45. Let's kick into Thursday's episode where Ali and James do some Christmas shopping and call it an episode.
I have come up with the Christmas present solution because I know that you're struggling. I know that everybody is struggling to come up with Christmas ideas this year.
Definitely.
And this is a selection of amazing gifts that are ideal for the most important person.
Is this something to do with, like, rodents that have been hit by cars and picked up and perhaps cast in iron or something that you can hang on the wall?
No, you're way off.
Okay, good. All right. That's fine. I'll stay on the show then. Keep going.
Really? Okay.
If you'll have me.
Okay, so I've found a selection of gifts ideal for the most important person in the house, which, you know.
What is it? Who's the most important person in the house?
Brittany. Oh.
The dog.
Yes.
Brittany
wrong?
The dog.
Yeah. Or the cat, if you prefer. I have a few cat ones as well.
Okay.
So, let's start.
So, that a bone doesn't do the trick for Christmas?
Well, that's kind of been done, hasn't it?
They like it.
Do they?
Yeah.
Well, you could probably maybe put a bone in the in their stocking and then like a main gift.
Okay.
What do you think?
A main gift.
This is the first one. Okay, it's a dog bed.
Dog bed, it certainly is.
And it is, it's a chenille chaise lounge. Is that how you say it?
It's a chaise. It's a chenille chaise.
Chaise lounge.
Chaise lounge, yeah, that's okay. It. Goodness me, look at that thing. It is velvet.
It is, well, it's chenille.
Oh,
it's
yes.
Velvet.
Is that what that is?
Okay. The legs here look like little crystal balls, like the legs of the thing look like little crystal balls, but in fact they are crystals, so they'd be about as big as your fist, if not bigger, these crystals. And there's four of them, obviously, so there's four legs. And if you see like the buttons, there's like probably 15,
it looks
between 15 and 30 like little studs in the thing, which are also crystal.
It looks like a piece of furniture out of a
Victorian,
Elizabethan sort of era, doesn't
it? It's beautiful, isn't it? And it's made for your dog. And
and how much is it?
It's $1,200.
Oh, is that all?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
That's $1,200. Okay. And it says, you know, your dog will have such a relaxing night's sleep that she'll wake up feeling like a movie star, especially since this bed is probably pricier than yours.
And that is what we want, for the dog to wake up feeling like a movie star and having a shit wherever it wants.
Okay, next. This is a house, a kennel, if you like. It is based on the Cape Cod style beach houses.
Oh, and there's the little dog next to it. It's huge.
Yeah, it's massive.
It's massive.
Like, that's a Labrador.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's stunning. It is absolutely stunning.
Jeez,
so,
does it come with a butler?
It's a replica Cape Cod style dog house. Not only does it have real roof shingles, it's also fully insulated and includes a fenced-in kennel area so that they can, you know, they've got room to move.
Run around.
It's massive, isn't it?
But
it looks really cool.
I don't know what to say about that. I thought we went overboard for the bunnies.
Oh.
But okay. No, this is
okay. It's very nice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, that's worth $2,695. So, still affordable.
Good.
I think that's a fairly good price.
That's actually a good price.
Considering what it is.
That's a bargain hunter's price.
Unlike the next one.
Yeah.
Which is, I think everyone's aware of Louis Vuitton. This is...
Now, he makes
bags and luggage,
right.
And things
like
that.
Yes, fashion.
Yes. This is a Louis Vuitton dog carrier. And it looks just like the Louis Vuitton bags. It's got, you know, the brown... with the sort of beige.
Oh, not those stupid,
trims.
Ridiculous bags that you pay thousands of dollars for.
Yeah, and they look terrible.
Oh.
They're so ugly, I know.
Ugly as.
Yeah. So we have a proper Louis Vuitton dog carrier, which is what such people as Jessica Simpson and Ashley Tisdale and stuff use to carry their dogs around.
Yeah.
But it is made of cowhide. So if your dog is a member of PETA, or, you know, has any sort of animal liberation feelings, then they might want to stay away from
this. They might not want it.
Yeah. Yes. $2,100 for this little...
$2,100 for that bag?
Yeah.
Any diamond studs on it?
No, it's Louis Vuitton. So I do believe that Louis Vuitton, all of their, like, all of the metal, like the zips, the studs, are actually gold.
I think the best way to describe it is to take one of those animal transport cubicle things that you see at the airport.
Yeah.
And then let Louis Vuitton go hell on it with a piece of leather.
Well, it looks just like the Louis Vuitton handbags, really.
It does.
So, yeah, that's another option. I'm not quite sure how your dog would feel. How do they feel about being carried around in a bag like that? That might not be a Christmas present for the dog. That's probably more for you. So.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. It's more of an owner's gift. This one is for the cat, and this is like a tree.
Wow, that's cool.
It's a scratching sort of climbing thing, but it is a tree with like many layers of climby bits with a little house at the bottom.
Wow.
I don't think people in Australia would need to purchase one of these because I'm pretty sure they could just go out the backyard and cut their tree down. And
a lot of people
That looks like something my dad made. I'm sorry.
It does,
but
it does. I don't know how it made it into this. That looks... See, a lot of people keep their cats inside and never let them out.
That's true, So it's 84 inches high.
Yeah.
And it's $999, which is very expensive considering that I think my dad could make a better looking one.
Yeah.
But it's custom made, so I guess they make it
custom
to how you want it, yeah. And it's made of real cedar wood and silk leaves and things. So it looks average, but it's made of cool stuff. Next we have, it's called a Labyrinth Aquarium, and there are like six fish bowls,
yep.
But they're all connected by like little tubes and stuff. So
imagine hamster balls connected with tubes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing. I really want one. They're really, really cool. So yeah, get on the website and check this one out because this is awesome. So yeah, the fish can swim from bowl to bowl.
Yeah.
And it's so cool.
So if they have a fight, one of them can piss off into their little lounge room and the other one can go off to their bedroom.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm assuming it all comes apart so that you can clean it and stuff, but it is so cool.
And how much?
It's $6,500, which is, oh no, it's a shame. But it does come with the stand that you see.
Oh,
so it's
okay.
I could knock
that up for $30.
But I mean, wow, it is so cool.
That's awesome.
So I'm putting that on my Christmas list. Oh, yeah. Look, here we go, a pet spa.
Good. Okay, yep. Now this is a practical gift. This is nice.
Yes, it is. Yes. So, you know, after a long day rolling around in the mud, why wouldn't you want to have a spa? So, yeah, it's so this is, there is actually a YouTube video which I haven't looked at, but you can hook it up to any indoor or outdoor faucet, and it's got massaging jets and like an adjustable shower head and stuff like that, and it's pretty swish.
It does look very swanky. Swish. I'd like to get into that thing, actually.
Yeah, it looks comfy, doesn't it?
Wow, I'd buy that. Would you wash me in that?
I'd spray you with the water.
Could you spray me?
Yeah, I wouldn't wash you, but I'd spray you with the water.
What if I rolled around in the mud?
That's $1,250 for that one, which I think is pretty reasonable for something of that magnitude. Unlike this one coming up, let me tell you the price. It's $3,000 for this.
Okay.
It's dog perfume. $3,000 dog perfume.
What's that made from?
It's made from a rare flower, from sandalwood. So it looks like it might be more of a natural type thing. But $3,000, can you even buy human perfume for that much?
No, I don't think so. And how much do you get a tiny little...
It looks small, doesn't it?
Looks good.
It looks very,
great.
Very small. The worst thing about this is that it's so popular that they have a VIP list that you can only buy it by invitation only. So, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
I know. It's not cool. It's ridiculous. So, yeah.
Wow, insanely ridiculously cool.
Everyone should hold their breath for an invitation for that.
Hoping to get invited to buy it.
I'd be like, you know what? Fuck off. This is the last one, and it's probably the most stunning. It's a dog collar. It's called Amour Amour. Mm-hmm. So it's the Amour Amour diamond dog collar.
Okay.
And I'm not sure whether it's Amour Amour because they want more or whether it's actually supposed to mean love.
We need more money.
You must love the dog to buy this, but your dog probably has to be slightly selfish.
Sure.
So if you've got some spare money lying around.
How much?
3.2 mil.
Oh!
Yeah. But it's 52.2 carats of diamonds.
Wow.
Yeah. Includes more than 1,600 handset diamonds. Yeah. So, I mean, it's an amazing piece of jewellery. But why would you
and
not want to wear that yourself?
And it's made for a dog. It's not as though...
It's a dog collar.
Yeah, right.
It is a dog collar. Yeah. So anyway, I think I've solved... Well, I know I've solved your problems.
Yes.
For Christmas, because you could buy that for me, any of those for me. I'd be happy to.
Oh, thank you so much.
So Britt and I would be happy to receive
any of those. I am eternally indebted to you for providing that list for me to buy you.
Fat chance, Ali. There's no way I'm buying you any of that crap. And now on to our second musical piece for this week. This is Section 8. We'll be right back.
Section 8 there with Blackwing Butterfly. Lovely little song. And now, since there was no time for a Friday show this week, we're going to give you some of the North Korean news that I've been pumping out over the last few days. Hello, listeners, and welcome to the first in a series of special reports on the Korean situation. This one from abc.net.au, written by Mark Colvin. The Korean War stopped for practical purposes in 1953, but technically it never ended. This is a matter of theory for most people around the world, but clearly for the North Korean leadership and many of its brainwashed people, it's a brutal reality. This week's shelling by North Korea off the South Korean island of Gyeongpyeong was just the latest illustration of this attitude. There are few countries left that genuinely qualify for the title of rogue state, but North Korea is unquestionably one. Because it's so implacably locked off from the world, with the small numbers of visitors allowed visas confined to rigid and closely watched itineraries, few people in the outside world know much about it. But there are clues available, painstakingly put together by people who specialize in this most enigmatic of countries, and the overall picture they paint is uniformly horrifying. Mark Colvin's program, PM, has taken a keen interest in North Korea over the last decade, and he thought, in the context of the attacks, that he'd bring together here some of what he's learned from those experts. So, what kind of country is North Korea? No statistics bring the economic failure of the Kim dynasty more graphically than the one unearthed by the author Barbara Demick. There are, by some estimates, 30,000 refugees in China, some of whom make it to South Korea eventually. Demick researched their physical health and discovered that if you compare your average 17-year-old South Korean with a North Korean refugee the same age, there's about a 5-inch difference in height. Now, this is a racially identical population. In 1953, at the end of the war, there was no difference in height. The difference is entirely down to nutrition. Not only has North Korea experienced a series of catastrophic famines in which hundreds of thousands have died, but the people of North Korea have been systematically starved for more than half a century. A country where the school children sing a song called "We Have Nothing to Envy in the World" is actually a hell of permanent rationing in which people regularly forage in the countryside for insects, berries, and roots to keep their families alive. And if you get sick from malnutrition in North Korea, you'll be lucky to see a doctor. This is a country which the World Health Organization reports spends less than $1 per person per year on health. Result? Major operations performed without anesthetic, and doctors and surgeons working not for money, but for food, cigarettes, and alcohol. The reason is that the vast bulk of the country's income is channeled to two protected sectors. The first is the leadership itself, and there have been plenty of stories to attest to Kim Jong-il's taste for Western luxuries. The second is the military, including the country's massive nuclear program, new details of which this week suggest that the aim is now not just an A-bomb, but an H-bomb. North Korea is, as everyone, including viewers of South Park, knows, the fiefdom of the dictator Kim Jong-il, who succeeded his father Kim Il-sung. Now it appears that Kim Jong-il is to be succeeded by his own son, Kim Jong-un. This hereditary principle makes the country, as some would say, the world's first communist kingdom. But one influential career expert says that neither communism nor the family business nature of the government is the real organizing principle of North Korea. That, says B.R. Myers, is racism. A profound belief that Koreans are uniquely pure and morally superior to all other races by virtue of their bloodline. The corollary, of course, is that everyone else is racially inferior. Myers says that North Korea's hatred of the United States, its animosity towards the outside world in general, is implacable. It derives from a race-based way of looking at the world. This regime cannot go from being a military-first government to an economy-first government without, in essence, becoming irrelevant, without, in essence, becoming a kind of fourth-rate South Korea. In sum, we're looking at a racist, totalitarian state which acts with extreme unpredictability and which now undoubtedly has nuclear weapons capacity, though its capacity to deliver is still not fully understood. Countries it threatens include Japan and especially South Korea, states with which Australia has extremely strong trade and diplomatic ties. The writer Christopher Hitchens, who has visited North Korea as a journalist, canvassed the diplomatic and military options when Mark Colvin spoke to him in May. If the North Koreans were to start an outright war, he said, that would be the end. We would be able to demolish their regime, and we'd be able to demolish it before it got, which it keeps getting, inching nearer to actual nuclear capacity. Question. Demolish it how? Answer. Well, it's... Look, if it wasn't for the threat that it poses to the South, there is another thing, by the way, it's said to be able to do, which is to open its dams and send water flooding into northern part of the Republic of Korea, so it has a conceivably devastating repartee, but only once. It doesn't have any follow-up capacity, and all its main nuclear and other facilities could be taken out. It would be an afternoon's work of a wing of the US Air Force to take that out, and then we never have to worry about that again. Question. That would be a frightful decision for anyone to be taking. Answer. And then we would have upon us the responsibility, suddenly, for the care and feeding of millions of starved, ignorant, traumatized, desperate North Koreans, the world's worst potential refugee problem. That really puts it into perspective, doesn't it? In the light of that, it's easier to see why, even under heavy shelling of one of its islands or the fatal ramming of one of its warships, as happened earlier this year, South Korea is proceeding with diplomatic caution. There is one country which still has real influence with North Korea, and that's China. The Lowy Institute's Rory Medcalf says, "The key here is China's role. China is the only power with the real capacity to harm the regime in Pyongyang, as it proved when it cut off energy supplies briefly after the nuclear test in 2006. China's response will be a grand test of whether it puts the region's interests ahead of its own relations with its dangerous little brother in Pyongyang. Beijing still absurdly denies that North Korea sank the South Korean warship back in March, even though a credible international investigation proved otherwise. But Beijing can hardly deny what happened yesterday. If it takes a business-as-usual approach, its relations with South Korea will be wrecked, and its chances of a working security relationship with the United States will be lost, perhaps for years." As Medcalf says, it's unfortunate that US-China relations are in a trough at present. Between them, the two superpowers really need to do something to control this most dangerous and unpredictable of international irritants. The consequences of failure could be huge. Hello, listeners, and welcome to GSS for today. We don't actually have time to do a proper episode for you. We have been out rushing all day, and right now, James and Ali are wrapped around computers editing to make the ad for James's little business. But we do have some more news on the Korean situation. North Korea's attack on South Korea's Yeonpyeong Island Tuesday was deadlier than it seemed. Two civilians died, in addition to the two South Korean soldiers. The bodies of the civilians were discovered Wednesday from a construction site. Both were men and believed to be in their 60s. In response to the attack, President Obama is sending an aircraft carrier to partake in joint exercises with South Korea. And of course, following on from there, the wonderful reporters out of the Daily Beast. In this case, Tim Shorrock have a bit of a response. As the US dispatches a carrier to the region, experts who have recently visited Pyongyang warned the Obama administration that the only choice to resolve the conflict is direct negotiation. As the Obama administration dispatches an aircraft carrier to the region following North Korea's deadly and unprovoked shelling of South Korea, experts warn that the United States only has one choice in dealing with Kim Jong-il's regime: direct negotiations. That's the message from several American Korea experts who have recently visited the Democratic People's Republic of Korea and talked to its leaders. Contrary to what has been advocated by the Pentagon, the Obama administration, and members of the Republican Party, these experts say that direct negotiations are the only way to end Pyongyang's nuclear weapons program and eventually move towards a peace agreement to formally end the conflict. Quote, "The only way out of this box is to negotiate," Leon Segal, the director of the Northeast Asian Cooperative Security Project at the Social Science Research Council in New York, told the Daily Beast. Segal, who visited Pyongyang last week with two former State Department officials, added, "North Korea is prepared in detail to do things advantageous to the United States that are not impossible to do." The Obama administration, however, has made it clear that no talks with the North Korean government of Kim Jong-il are possible until the regime abandons its nuclear weapons program. In the wake of the shelling incident, President Obama announced that U.S. and South Korean forces will hold joint military exercises in the region that will include the aircraft carrier George Washington and other U.S. Navy warships. Quote, "We've had an underlying philosophy of not rewarding bad behavior with concessions," a senior administrator official told reporters. In recent days, however, North Korea has opened the door for a possible shift in policy. In their meetings with North Koreans, Segal and former U.S. officials Joe Witt and Morton Abramowitz were told that Pyongyang is prepared to ship out all of its nuclear fuel rods, the key ingredient for producing weapons-grade plutonium, to a third country in exchange for a U.S. commitment to pledge that it has no hostile intent towards North Korea. Such a pact could set the stage for reopening the six-party talks, which were initiated during the Bush administration by the United States and South Korea to end the nuclear standoff. These talks, which also involve Japan, China, and Russia, have faltered over questions of verification and compliance. They have also been complicated by a series of reckless military actions on the part of North Korea, which is widely considered to be one of the world's most repressive police states, where at least 1 million people have died from starvation over the last 15 years. North Korea, in turn, has accused Washington and Seoul of reneging on earlier agreements, including a promise to supply energy for North Korea's moribund economy in return for shutting down its nuclear reactor at Yongbyon. It remains closed. Pyongyang was also disappointed when President Obama broke a campaign pledge to talk directly with Pyongyang and instead intensified U.S. sanctions. This week's news that North Korea has built a new facility to enrich uranium and is building another reactor is a sign that those sanctions have failed, asserted Segal. Without direct negotiations, he said, North Korea was likely to keep enriching uranium, restart its reactor at Yongbyon, conduct another nuclear test as it did in 2006, and test more missiles. Quote, "I know it's very hard to talk to these guys, but there's no other way," he said. Segal's views were supported by three Americans who were shown North Korea's new uranium enrichment plant earlier this month. Quote, "You have to address the fundamentals of North Korean security," Siegfried Heckler, the former director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, told an audience in Washington on Tuesday. Stanford professors Robert Carlin and John W. Lewis, who accompanied Heckler to North Korea, wrote in the Washington Post that, quote, "Being realistic about the North makes no moral judgment about its systems or politics. The United States must start by accepting the existence of North Korea as it is, a sovereign state with its own interests," they argued. A second option, analysts said, is to take steps to de-escalate the tense military standoff near the disputed maritime border on the west coast between North and South Korea. That line, drawn unilaterally by the U.S. Navy when the Korean War ended in 1953, has never been recognized by the North. It has been at the center of many of the military clashes between the two countries in recent years, including Tuesday's artillery battle. The skirmish began, South Korean authorities said, when Pyongyang warned Seoul to halt a huge military drill in the area that involved over 70,000 South Korean troops, 50 warships, 90 helicopters, and 500 planes. Seoul refused to stop and commenced firing artillery rounds into the disputed waters. The North retaliated by shelling the island of Yeonpyeong, subjecting civilians and private homes to what the Korean daily Hankyore calls indiscriminate attack. John Pfeiffer, the author of a 2003 book on the United States and North Korea, who has written critically of Kim Jong-il's authoritarian government, said the incident underscores the dangers of military exercises at a time of volatility. "This is what happens when you take a confrontational approach near a disputed border," he said. The area near Yeonpyeong is where North Korea allegedly torpedoed and sank a South Korean naval ship in March, sending 46 sailors to their death and sharply escalating tensions. According to Seagal, who recently published a detailed history of North-South clashes, the naval ship may have been targeted by North Korea to avenge an incident in November 2009 when the South Korean Navy fired shots at a North Korean vessel that crossed the demarcation line, killing several North Korean sailors. Naval clashes in the western area escalated after South Korean President Lee Myung-bak, a conservative businessman who rejects South Korea's previous policies of détente, unilaterally backed away from a summit agreement reached by his predecessor with Kim Jong-il in 2007. That agreement included a pledge to establish a joint fishing area in the region and to discuss measures to build military confidence that might help avoid future clashes. Had those steps been carried out, said Seagal, the recent confrontations might have been avoided. Washington's role on the Korean Peninsula is critical because the United States maintains 28,000 ground troops in South Korea and holds operational command over Korean forces in times of war, an aberration that makes South Korea the only country in the world in such a situation. Christine Ahn, a fellow with the Berkeley-based Korea Policy Institute and a longtime peace activist, said Tuesday's events underscore the need to bring a final end to the Korean War and demilitarize the peninsula. Quote, "Not having a peace treaty leaves room open for these kind of skirmishes," she said. "No one wants to live under the constant threat of war, North or South." Thanks to Tim Shorrock there of the Daily Beast for an excellent report on what's going on there. We have one more quick one before we call it. Determined to show its strength in the aftermath of Tuesday's attacks by North Korea, South Korea has vowed to send more troops to the small island near their disputed shared border. But perhaps undercutting the nation's efforts, South Korean Defense Minister Kim Tae-yong hinted at internal disarray by announcing his resignation on Thursday. Kim had offered to resign in May after the sinking of the warship that was allegedly attacked by North Korea, but the president chose to keep him in his post. Now the South Korean leadership, backed by the United States, has shifted its focus to ramping up pressure on China to act against its ally. South Korea's president warned his cabinet that the country should not let our guard down. He added through a spokesman, "I think a similar North Korean provocation could come at any time." No lowering of instability in the region yet, but we live in hope. Ah, that's good. It reminds me of the good old days when the Great Southern Stand had less fluff and more substance. Now we're going to round out the show this week with a mighty song from the mighty Patient Zero. This is No More the Pain. Tomorrow, of course, you can tune in for James's attack on the musical sensibilities of the world. But I will see you on Monday for the start of a brand new week of GSS. Have yourselves a fabulous weekend. Hopefully the Asian Pacific region won't be blown to shit by the time we see you again. Thanks for listening, guys. Catch you next time.